She is the founding lecturer from the Simon Wiesenthal Center up in Los Angeles. She goes all over the world speaking, sharing her testimony, telling people about her experience in the Holocaust. And I believe that the timing is so appropriate for us to have her as we're going into the fall holidays. Yom Zikaron is the day of remembrance. And I believe it's very important that we, as believers, take time to remember the things that she's going to share with us today. Because don't you know that the world is trying to deny this season in history, the Holocaust, and there is a new wave of anti-Semitism rising across the face of the earth today that is probably going to end up as in larger proportion than the one in World War II. And I think that it's important that we remember the Holocaust. As you and I have been getting back to our Jewish roots in our faith, Judeo-Christianity, one thing that is so unique that's taking place in my own life is I know I am feeling one with the Jewish people. When I hear of things happening to the Jewish people, I, in my own heart and spirit, feel like it's happening to me and to my family. And I know many of you are having that same experience as our love for the Jewish people grows. And as this anti-Semitism grows across the face of the earth, I believe it's important for you and I to take a stand against it. And I believe one of the best ways to combat it is to follow the leading of our sister Ruth in the Word of God. And I just want to read to you these scriptures because these scriptures are really the heart of this congregation.
Amen.
Ruth says, "Don't press me to leave you and stop following you. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people. And your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May Adonai bring terrible curses upon me, and worse ones as well, if anything but death separates you and me." I believe that should be the heartfelt cry of the church today towards our Jewish brothers and sisters. And so would you join me in welcoming Renee Firestone. You're going to have to turn her up a little more, Mike, if you can. Yeah, it's on. Just go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Shalom. Shalom. As you know, my name is Renee, and I am a Holocaust survivor. Well, first let me explain a Holocaust survivor, because most people believe that Holocaust survivors are only people who went through concentration camps or extermination camps. Well, we look at Holocaust survivors differently because we know that between the years of 1933, when Hitler was elected Chancellor of Germany, and 1945, when the war ended and the Holocaust ended, between those years, if any Jewish family, and in Europe it was almost all Jewish families, had to be uprooted and taken somewhere, whether they were taken into camps or whether they escaped and were in hiding somewhere, or whether they were lucky enough to leave the country and find another country that was willing to accept them, because most of the countries of the world actually closed their borders to us, so it was almost impossible. After 38, 39, it was almost impossible to even escape. But there were some who were smart enough to do that a little earlier. So all those people who had to uproot their families, take them away from their homes, are Holocaust survivors. So I just wanted to clarify. I, unfortunately, am one of those who went through the Nazi camps. And I will, of course, talk about that later. But as a Holocaust survivor who actually experienced the greatest human tragedy in the history of mankind, I feel today, because I survived, that it is my duty to warn and to remind the world what happened during that time, and that it can happen and it is happening today. Not necessarily to the Jewish people, but when I was liberated from the camps, I was then 21 years old, I was young, naive, and I truly believed that after what we went through and what the world went through, humanity learned something, and that there will never, never be another war or another genocide. And how wrong was I? I know that 20-some years later, I was already in the United States, I was asked, would I join a small group of people to go to Washington to plead for Cambodian children whose parents were already murdered in the killing fields, and to ask our government to help these children because they were dying of starvation. Pol Pot would not allow the trucks with the food to reach the children, and hundreds of them were dying every single day. And I remember we went to Washington and we were pleading and begging, and then they told us, well, you're already back east, why don't you go to New York and go to the United Nations and try to explain to them what's needed. And of course, hoping that the United Nations was created for that purpose, to save people from genocide, we went to Washington and we pleaded with the head of the United Nations. And I came back very disappointed because this man didn't promise or offer us anything. When I turned on the television a few weeks later, I am listening and I don't believe what I hear. The same man who was the head of the United Nations, and we were pleading with him to save the children of Cambodia, was a Nazi. Wartheim, who was a Nazi and who was killing Jewish children in Yugoslavia during the war. And I thought to myself, what is this world coming to? Who are we? Who are we going to ask for help if this can happen? And so, from then on, of course, I have committed myself to make sure that I talk about my experiences and how this can happen if we don't learn to respect one another as human beings, if we don't remember that we are our brother's keepers. And that is why I'm here today. I am going to give you a little bit of the history of what Nazism, how it really started, and how naive we were, not understanding what really is coming. As you know, there are genocides going on in the world today. While we are sitting here, there is a genocide going on in Darfur, in the Sudan. And again, the United Nations does nothing. And so I keep remembering how these things could happen without the people around this situation not know or not keep understanding that tragedies can happen to them. I remember as a child, I was 9 years old, when Hitler came to power in 1933. By 1935, 2 years later, in Germany, they had anti-Jewish laws, which reduced the... I'm sorry. which reduced the German the Jewish population to second-class citizens. All their rights were systematically stripped, and by a few months they had no rights at all. And when they had no rights, then the Nazi Party and the people of the Nazi Party believed that now they can do anything they want to the Jews. Some of them were well-to-do. Now we can take their monies away from them. Now we can go into their home and claim they have a piano. I need a piano. I can take it away from them. Where are they going to complain? There was nowhere to complain anymore. Their rights were gone. So I don't think that we comprehend what can happen when your human rights are taken away from you. And so slowly, systematically, the Jews became sort of prisoners in their own home. Now, I was born and raised in Czechoslovakia, which was a true democracy. Czechoslovakia was created by the United States after World War I. Both of our presidents, Thomas Masaryk and Edward Beneš, were professors at the Chicago University. And after World War I, with the help of the United States, they recreated this little country of Czechoslovakia, which was sitting in the heart of Europe. If any of you see the map of old Europe, you can see that it is surrounded with all these big countries in the middle, and it was a little long strip which started on the western front bordering Germany, but on the eastern front went all the way to the Soviet Union, to the Ukraine. And so it was a very unique democracy in Europe, which didn't exist around us. And all our laws and all our constitutions were imitated by the United States. And I grew up in this country, believing that we all are equal and that we all have the same rights. Well, I don't know whether you know history, but in 1938, Hitler was called upon by England and France, by Mr. Chamberlain and Mr. Daladier, questioning him, why is he creating an army? They noticed that Hitler is beginning to arm himself. And of course they were worried. This was only 20-some years after World War I. Europe cannot afford another war. So why is he doing this? And Hitler's answer was that part of Czechoslovakia, which is bordering with Germany, called the Sudetenland, used to belong to Germany, and he claimed it, he wants it back. And if England and France will allow him to occupy this territory, then he will stop arming himself, there will be no war in Europe, and everything is going to be fine. And England and France fell for it, and they signed all kinds of peace treaties with Hitler, and Mr. Chamberlain went back to England claiming this victory of peace. Well, we know that only a year later, September 1, 1939, World War II started anyway. Hitler invaded Poland. By then, he wiped Czechoslovakia off the map, and part of it he gave to Hungary, part of it he gave autonomy, and the part which is now the Czech Republic, he attached to Germany. And we lived in the very eastern corner of Czechoslovakia, which now became Hungary. I was 14 years old when overnight I became a Hungarian. Now, you can imagine, I went to Czech school, I spoke the Czech language, I had all my friends were Czechs. All of a sudden, my Czech friends left, they went back to Czech Republic, and we remained with the new Hungarian friends. Now I had to learn a new language, I was worried, how am I going to get back to school? Well, I soon found out that I didn't have to worry, because Hungary, by 1938, had similar anti-Jewish laws as Germany had. And Jewish children no longer could enter public schools. And so I remember, because the Jewish teachers were also dismissed from the school system, they started little workshops in their homes to earn a living. And so that's the kind of a school I went to after that. But my brother, I had a brother who was 5 years older than me, and a little sister who was 4.5 years younger than myself. And my brother was already in his graduating class. In Europe, you go 5 years to elementary school, and then you enter gymnasium. And you go 8 years of gymnasium. When you graduate from gymnasium, it is as if you would go 2 years of junior college in the United States. And so my brother was in this graduating class, and of course my parents were very upset that he won't be able to graduate, because they were hoping that this situation will end someday, and then he won't be able to enter a university without this diploma. But the Hungarian government, for some reason, and I even today I have no idea why, they decided that the 6 Jewish boys in the graduating class will be permitted to graduate, and these are going to be the last Jews graduating from gymnasium. And so that was wonderful news. But 5 days before graduation, my brother disappeared. He didn't come home from school. And my parents were running around the neighborhood. Nobody saw him. So following day, my parents hired a non-Jewish attorney, because Jewish lawyers no longer practiced. And he went to the police department, who knew nothing. So he later on went to the government, asking what happened to my brother. He came back to tell my parents that the 6 Jewish boys, by the way, my parents went first to the school, asking, of course, the principal and the school teacher, do they know what happened to my brother, who claimed they knew nothing. So the attorney went to the government. He came back telling my parents that the 6 Jewish boys were removed from the classroom by the Gestapo in front of the principal and the teacher, who claimed they knew nothing, and they were taken to a nearby town where they are being interrogated. About what? Well, they were accused of being communists, producing pamphlets and newspapers, which of course was nonsense. And the government decided that if the Jewish community in our town is willing to put together a certain amount of money, and they told my parents how much, then these boys would be released. And so next day my parents were running around the neighborhood to the Jewish families where they thought they can get some money, and collected the amount. And the boys were released. My brother came home. He was black and blue. He was beaten. He was tortured. And he refused to talk about it, because he was threatened that if he tells anybody what happened to him, he will be recaptured again. So the fact was that, for some reason, the government still allowed these 6 boys to graduate. But a few days after graduation, my brother receives a notice from the government telling him that now he is of military age, but Hungary does not take Jews into the military, and therefore all men of military age will have to enter a forced labor camp. So a few days later, my brother has to leave our home. And after that, we had very little contact with him. Occasionally, he was able to bribe one of the guards who would bring a little note to us, and we would send a little package to my brother. But it was very seldom. Most of the time, we had no idea where he was. And we were still living in our home. Now we were being stripped of our rights, just like the Jews of Germany. And then, of course, stripped of our possessions. The very first thing we had to turn in were our radios. And I remember that that was great tragedy for us, because when the Hungarians entered our region, they immediately notified the non-Jewish community that if they would have any contacts to any Jews, if they would help any Jews or hide any Jews or have them escape, they would be treated as Jews. So the non-Jewish community was now scared to have any contact with us. Our next door neighbors, with whom we were like family before, now they were afraid to greet us. And so we were totally isolated, and now the radios were taken away, so we had no contact with the outside world. And then, of course, we lived in a very cold climate, so almost everybody, every man, woman, and child had some kind of a fur coat. Those were taken away later on, the jewelry, and later on our bankrolls. One day they walked into my father's business. My father had a textile and tailoring business, and they told him to just give up the keys and the bags. He no longer owns this business. I will probably never forget that day. You know how all children believe that as long as their parents are alive, they will protect them, they will be safe. Well, that's what I believe. And then I see my father come home one day crying. My father, who was a strong, self-assured man, if he's crying, he must be in trouble. He couldn't protect himself. How is he going to protect me? And so from then on, times were very difficult. We didn't know how we were going to survive. And then all of a sudden, we had a curfew, that we couldn't leave our homes anytime we wanted to. Only certain times that we were allowed to leave our homes to take care of shopping or going to the doctors or whatever needed to be done outdoors. So times were very difficult for us. And then, as you know, September 1st, 1939, World War II started. This also started with some terrible ideas which we couldn't imagine. While we were Czechoslovakia, our most closest ally was the Soviet Union. And we knew that the Soviet Union has the strongest army in the world, and they will protect us. And now the war starts, and the Soviet Union joins Hitler invading Poland. How can that be? How can the Soviet Union make a treaty with Hitler? Well, Hitler knew that the Soviet Union had their eyes on one part of Poland. And so Hitler made an offer to Stalin, which he couldn't refuse. He told him that if he helps him invade Poland, Stalin will get his share of Poland. And Stalin fell for it. And they invade Poland from both ends. Stalin from the east, Hitler from the west. Poland falls. Within 4 days, the war is over. And sure enough, they divide Poland between the two of them. As soon as Hitler had part of Poland, he packs up some of the German Jews and pushes them over into Poland. Poland in 1939 has 3 million Jews. the largest Jewish community in the world. They cannot absorb any more Jews. So they don't allow the Jews to settle. And these German refugees now are roaming around in a so-called no man's land between Germany and Poland, not being to settle anywhere. And a few weeks later, the Nazi party decides that since these Jews have nowhere to go, why don't we just get rid of them? And they gather them up, they walk them into the middle of the deepest forest in Poland, they dig ditches for them, and they line them up against these ditches and shoot them. And these rumors are coming to us in Hungary, telling us that Jewish women, children, elderly are being shot into mass graves. And I am terrified. And I go to my father and I ask him, is it possible that innocent people are being shot only because they are Jews? Can it happen to me? And of course my father, the optimist, tells me that he and my mother every summer used to vacation in Germany. And they know the German people, and that the German people are the most educated, most cultured people in the world. People who love music and art and poetry. And people like that don't shoot innocent people into mass graves. Well, I'm now 15 and a half years old. That's all I want to hear. And I am now satisfied. But knowing that Hungary is one of the closest allies to Hitler, I keep worrying. Would it be possible that they are going to ship us to Poland? And that's the kind of life we live now, in fear all the time, what can happen to us. And the war is going on, and of course Hitler is fighting Western Europe, and he's very successful. He occupies Holland and Belgium and France and Greece. And every country he occupies, he immediately orders the new government to pack up the Jews and push them over to Poland. He will take care of them. And we don't know that all these Jews are already being murdered in mass graves or any other way. And the war is going on. And a year later, of course, Hitler invades the Soviet Union. And he starts the war with his best friend, with Stalin. And now we see Hitler marching into the Ukraine and into White Russia. And Russia is not fighting back. And we wonder, what's going on? The Soviet Union, who has the best army in the world, why don't they fight Hitler? Well, in 1942, we find out what is going on. Hitler sort of used the same politics or policy with Hitler as he used with Napoleon, if you know the history. He lured the German army to the coldest part of the Soviet Union. They wanted Hitler's army to reach this coldest part of the Soviet Union, hoping that when winter sets in, the climate will defeat Hitler. And that's exactly what happens. In 1942, in winter, Hitler's army is dying on the front line of the cold. They are freezing to death. Their animals freeze. Their weapons don't work. And the Russians now are waiting for them, prepared to push them out of the Soviet Union. And while this is happening, Hitler has great problems. Hitler has great problems because when he was marching into the Soviet Union, he did to the Jews the same thing he did in Poland. He was shooting them into mass graves. And now he's worried that these mass graves will be discovered by the Soviet army as they are pushing him out of the Soviet Union. But why was he so terribly worried? He thought that the Jews don't count, that any country in Europe would agree with him to kill the Jews. Well, in the Soviet Union, near Kiev, in the Ukraine, was the largest mass grave called Babi Yar. And in this grave, within 3 days, he murdered about 36,000 Jews. But he made a terrible mistake here, because in that same grave in Babi Yar, he shot 1,800 Soviet officers who he captured and who were Jews. And so now he was worried that if this grave is discovered, this becomes an international incident. He's shooting prisoners of war into mass graves. So he made his own army stop at Babi Yar, dig up the grave, and burn all the bodies, rebury the ashes, hoping that nobody will ever know about Babi Yar. But now he has another problem. There are some Jews left in Europe. In Free France, there were some Jews left. In Greece, on one of the islands of Salonika, there were still some Jews. And he knew that the Hungarian Jews are still at home. Well, he often asked the Hungarian president, who was his best ally and best friend, to pack up the Jews and push them over to Poland. But our president always refused, telling him that he needs his Jews to work for him. And he referred to the forced labor camps. And so we sort of felt safe as long as these men were working as free laborers for Hungary, maybe we will remain at home. And now the war is coming to an end. On the Western Front, the Americans are already in the war, and England is in the war, and they are successful on the Western Front. And the Russians are moving, pushing the Germans out of the Soviet Union. So maybe, we thought, we, the Hungarian Jews, are going to be the only Jews of Europe who will remain intact at home. And that's what we were hoping for. And of course, Hitler is pushed out of the Soviet Union, and the Americans are pushing Hitler out of the Western countries, and we are still at home, and it's 1944, March 1944. The German army winds up on the borders of Hungary. And we were convinced that they are going to bypass us, go back to Germany, the war is going to be finished. It doesn't happen. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen because at this point, Hitler finds out why our president did not give up his Jews. Our president was very clever. He figured out that if Hitler would win the war and he would want him to kill the Jews, he doesn't have to use money for trains and military escorts. He can shoot the Jews right here in Hungary. Why does he have to send them to Poland? But he also figured, what if Hitler doesn't win the war? And he figured out that if Hitler didn't win the war and he would save his Jews, he would be able to convince the Allies that he was really not a partner to Hitler, because he was the only country in Europe who saved his Jews. And, of course, when Hitler's army reaches our borders, Hitler finds out that our president is already communicating with the Allies, telling the Allies what a good guy he was. And he invites our president to Berlin, where he keeps him hostage while the German army marches into Hungary. And of course, at that point, we knew that we are doomed. Our president winds up in a concentration camp and is liberated after the war by the Americans, and finishes his life in Switzerland. But we are immediately notified that we are going to be relocated. By the way, the Holocaust had a language of its own. Partially it was euphemism, partially it was made up. And so, what does it mean we're going to be relocated? Well, they tell us that we're going to be taken to Germany, because the Hungarian Jews are the only Jews who are still in good physical condition. They are still able to work. So they are going to be taken to Germany. They are going to harvest producing food for the army, which is now in trouble, and producing war machinery for Hitler. And that's what the Hungarian Jews are going to be doing. And I remember, I am now 20 years old, I go to my father asking him, what does he think? And my father says to me that even though Hitler cannot be trusted, it seems that he is in real trouble, and most probably he will need our help. I think it's yeah. This. And I believe that my father is right, and most probably the war is going to be over within a few months, and we are going to be back home in no time. Well, we are given 24 hours. Each of us can pack a suitcase, which we will be able to take with us. We are given the size of the suitcase and the weight of the suitcase. And I remember my father watching over us that we should take the right thing with us, to have a warm jacket or a sweater if we stay in the, you know, in the winter time, and take another pair of shoes and take a little soap and toothbrush and nonsense. I mean, things that today when I think back seem so ridiculous. But we pack a suitcase and we are taken to the railroad station where there are cattle cars waiting. Well, we figure if we're going to Germany to work, certainly we're going to be taken on passenger trains. So I remember that we tell each other that Hitler must be in real trouble. He doesn't have passenger trains left because he needs them all to evacuate his army. So therefore, we will be transported on these cattle cars. And they pack us into these cattle cars. The cattle car I was in, there is about 120 of us. There is hardly room to put our suitcases down. And we know that we're going to be standing. There is no room to sit down. So I remember some of my young colleagues at my age, we decide to help the elderly, and we select out the old people and we let them sit at the edges of the cattle cars so they don't have to be standing through the journey. And we take children, babies out of the arms of young mothers, making it easier for them, and place the babies' children in the laps of the elderly. They lock the cattle cars from the outside. They don't give us any food or any water. In one of the corners of the cattle car is an empty bucket surrounded with a little bit of straw. So, of course, we figure out that's going to be our bathroom. And the journey begins. And we travel through that whole day into the night. And in the middle of the night, in the darkness, the train stops. And of course, we start reaching for our suitcases, hoping that we arrived to our destination. We can't see anybody or anything. But they don't open the cattle cars. And instead, the Nazi soldiers who are escorting the train are banging on the walls of the cattle cars, telling us that if we are hiding any money or any valuables, any jewelry, gold, silver, whatever, which we were supposed to deposit on the way out of our homes, if we are hiding any of that, we should give it up now, or we are going to suffer consequences. And while they are talking to us, we hear shooting and screaming outside. And of course, we are convinced that they are searching people and finding some stuff and maybe killing them. This goes on for a few hours, and all of a sudden, it gets quiet, and the train moves, and we are on the way again. Well, we traveled 3.5 days. Each night, the 3 nights, this looting is going on. I remember in the darkness, I used to watch, does anybody have anything to give up? Or if they don't, are we all going to be punished because of, then you find somebody on, you know, something on somebody. And I remember I see young married women taking off their little gold bands, their little wedding bands, and through the cracks of the cattle car, giving it up to the Nazis. And I, being 20 years old, I just left my first boyfriend behind, hoping that I will come back and life will continue. And now I see these young women giving up the symbol of their married life, of their vows. How can somebody be so cruel as to take away this the symbol of family from them? Well, of course, we didn't know how much worse things are awaiting us, so we thought that this was the greatest tragedy in the world. Well, on the 4th day, the train stops, and through the cracks we see that it's daytime. And we hear the latches being opened. So now we know that we arrived to our destination. Well, let me go back for a moment to 1942, when Hitler is being pushed out of the Soviet Union. And what we did not know, that at that same time, Hitler, in desperation, not to know what to do with the rest of the Jews, not being able to shoot them anymore into mass graves, he calls a conference, which is known as the Wannsee Conference, where they invite 15 military hierarchy and some heads of German industries to decide what to do with the remnants of the Jews. And they come up with something which is known today as the final solution to the Jewish problem. And what is the final solution to the Jewish problem? Well, they will build efficient German killing factories, places where they will build gas chambers big enough to kill 1,000 people at a time. And like in a very efficient factory on conveyors, the bodies will be carried up into crematorias, where the bodies will be burned, the ashes will be dispersed. Nobody will know what happened to the remnants of the Jews. This is the most efficient way to discard. And we, of course, have no idea because this is Hitler's biggest secret. And so we have no idea that 6 of these extermination camps are built in 1942. And that many Jews of Europe are already murdered here. And we also have no idea that all these extermination camps are built in Poland. Not one of them on German soil. So Hitler covers himself that if he's discovered, he would claim the Poles. He didn't have anything to do with this. And so now the cattle cars are open, and I push myself to the front, thinking I'm in Germany. I am going to be one of the first ones off that train, finding myself a good job for me and for my father, because we are going to save the family. My little sister is 14 years old. I don't know how hard she can work. My mother always suffered from migraine headaches, so I don't know whether she will be able to work hard, but my father and I, we will save the family. And I jump off the cattle car, and immediately I have this premonition that something is wrong. Something doesn't match the promise we had about working in Germany. I see a huge village surrounded with barbed wires. Within this village, there are rows and rows of wooden barracks divided with two rows of barbed wire. There are hardly any people there. Here and there I see a human skeleton walking in a striped uniform, like in a prisoner's uniform. Well, maybe this is a prison. If it is a prison, what am I doing here? What kind of work am I going to do in prison? Around this village, I see wooden towers, so many feet apart. In each tower, there is a machine gun pointing down to the railroad station where we are. Why are they watching us with machine guns? Where are the fields we're going to harvest? Or the factories where we're going to be working? So I have a terrible feeling. And now I see that the train we arrived on has no end. And thousands of people are pouring out of these trains. Tremendous chaos. Children, little children, running around, crying, looking for their parents. Mothers calling the names of their children. And suddenly I turn around and I don't see where my parents are. And I'm holding on to my little sister who is crying and telling me to wait for mother and dad. And I know in this crowd I may never find them. So now I'm reassuring her not to worry. Wherever they are going to take us, we will find mother and dad. And we are caught up in this crowd, and we are pulled into one direction, and on the loudspeakers now the Nazis are telling us to obey orders, to follow directions. Now we're going to go into a bathhouse to take a shower, to refresh ourselves, and then we will immediately be assigned to our work. Well, that sounds okay. At the same time, we see Nazi soldiers on the railroad tracks marching up and down, holding on to vicious dogs, teasing the dogs at the people pouring out of the train, keeping these people with the dogs in line, and we are being pushed in one direction. And suddenly I notice that I'm approaching a Nazi officer who has a leather whip in his hand, and when we approach him, he looks people over and he decides who is going what direction. Some people are directed to the right of the railroad track, some to the left, others in different directions. And now I really worry. Are they going to separate us? Where are my parents are going? Is he going to take my sister away from me? And I come in front of him. He takes one look at me and he points me to the right, but he doesn't let my sister go. So I wait. I'm holding on to my sister, waiting, and he keeps looking at me and looking at her. Well, I am now 20 years old. I am in very good physical condition. I was a gymnast, an athlete. I have long blonde hair, happen to have blue eyes, so he immediately knew where I'm going. But my 14-year-old sister is in that growing age. She's tall, skinny, a brunette, very dark brown hair, piercing black eyes, looks totally different from me. and he's looking at her and looking at me. And then he taps me on the shoulder again and he says, "You go." And I grab my sister and I yell to her, "Run!" And the two of us start running to the right, to the group where I'm supposed to go. When I arrive to this group, they are yelling at me. And I don't know what they are screaming, and they are talking something, calling something Dr. Mengele. And I have no idea what they are talking about. Well, later I find out that they were telling me that the man who separated us was none other than the infamous Dr. Mengele, who, if you disobey him, takes out his revolver and shoots you on the spot. And they are telling me how lucky I am that I wasn't shot. Well, I had no idea who Dr. Mengele was, and I had no idea what they were saying. I was only glad that my sister was with me. And so now we are told that we're going to march about a mile and a half to the bathhouse. But we are curious, who is going to the left? Why are they separating the people? And we notice that all the elderly people and the very young, younger than 15, 14 years of age, who are not tall enough, skinny, weak, are going to the left. And now we see military trucks coming, putting these people on military trucks. And I think to myself, that's a good sign. They are taking the weak by truck. They told us we're going to be walking. And my sister suddenly starts crying. She sees my mother being put up on the truck. And I reassure her not to worry, that mother is going to be wherever our taking us long before us, because we're going to be walking. And I said, "Don't worry, mother is going to be ready for us, like always. She's going to be prepared, everything is going to be set for us. We won't have to worry about anything." And she calms down, and we walk that mile and a half into an underground dressing room, where they tell us to get undressed, to fold our belongings very neatly, tie your shoes together so they don't get separated, and remember exactly where you placed your belongings, because when you come out of the shower, you will have to dress quickly to be assigned to your work. Well, it sounds great. We walk into the shower room. The dressing room doors are locked behind us. A commando walks in, removes all our belongings, and we, after a 1 minute ice cold shower, come out on the other side of the shower room into a clearing where the Nazis and the dogs are waiting for us. And now we are surrounded with these dogs. It is late afternoon. It's freezing. We are hugging each other for a little body warmth. The dogs are snapping, jumping, barking at us. The Nazi soldiers are making fun of the naked women, and we are standing there into the middle of the night when a soldier comes and selects about 1,000 of us and pushes us into a barrack, a wooden barrack. Here they shave our heads, our bodies, they spray us with DDT, with a pesticide. And then they hand us a recycled dress, which we have never seen such clothing, must have been coming from the Russian front. And they don't fit anybody, so we among ourselves have to exchange this garment to be able to put on our bodies. No underwear, no shoes. And as we are leaving the bathhouse, a prisoner is standing at the door with a bucket of yellow paint and a brush about 5 inches wide, and paints a yellow streak from the top of our shaved head down through our back. And that's how they take us into the campsite. It's total darkness. We have no idea where we are. We have no idea what's going to happen to us. We believe that now they are going to bring the machine guns and they are going to finish us off. What else can they do to us? And we are waiting, and hours go by in this darkness, and all of a sudden a burst of flames and smoke and ash is falling all over out of four brick chimneys, which we haven't noticed before. And we are wondering, what is happening? The sky becomes red. It looks like hell. What's going on here? And now we are really worried, wondering what those flames are. And one of the prisoners has an idea, and she yells, "Don't worry, don't worry. Those must be the factories we're going to be working at." And we think, maybe she's right. Maybe we are very pessimistic. Maybe she's right. Maybe those are the factories. And we're beginning to feel a little more secure. And we think, well, maybe we will be working. And then many hours later, another prisoner has an idea, and her idea is even better, because she thinks that those are bakeries, because she smells something burning. And those must be bakeries, and you will see tomorrow morning they are going to bring bread for us. But you understand, 4 days without food already. So bread, the word bread, is enough to change our mood. And now we are really waiting for daybreak, because bread will come. And daybreak comes. You guessed, bread did not. Instead, some overseers arrive. We call our sub-overseers capos. And these capos carry clubs like baseball bats. And they come, and without explaining or telling us anything, they are beginning to beat us. They are beating us and yelling something in German which sounds like Zählappel. And we are asking each other, anybody knows what Zählappel means? Nobody seems to know. So what could it be? And they are beating and shoving and pushing. And this is going on. Now it's daytime, it's noon, it's afternoon, and it's late afternoon, and we are still being pushed and shoved and beaten. And finally we realized that they wanted us to stand in columns of five to be lined up to be counted. And we're standing there in this line, my sister standing next to me, and some of the people who were beaten to death are lying in front of us. Some of them still moving, but not able to get up anymore. And I think to myself, maybe Zählappel means that's how they are going to kill us. The next Zählappel, it may be me or my sister. And I am really worried. And my sister starts crying again, asking me to find out when are we going to be reunited with our parents. And in my ignorance, I walk over to one of these overseers and very politely ask her, does she know when we're going to be reunited with our parents? And she looks at me and she points to one of the chimneys and she says, "You don't see? You don't see the fire and the smoke? There go your parents." And she says, "When you go through the chimney, you'll be reunited." And I think to myself, what is she talking about? And I turn to my fellow prisoners and I say, anybody knows what does it mean I'm going to go through the chimneys? Why would I go through the chimneys? What does that mean? And then, of course, the German entourage with Mengele at the head come and count us. And after being counted, they dismiss us. And now we have a chance to talk to the older prisoners. And I stop one of them and I say, do you know what does that mean? I'm going to go through the chimneys. And she laughs at me and she says, you think you're in Germany? You think you came here to work? You're in the largest extermination camp in Poland called Auschwitz-Birkenau. And you're not leaving this place any other way but through those chimneys. Well, I'm sitting here now 62 years later, wondering, why me? Why did I survive? Why didn't my little sister survive, who was smarter, younger, prettier? Why isn't she sitting in my chair? And then, many years later, I found out that those who were taken by truck were taken immediately to the gas chambers. My mother never even entered the camp. My father, who was brought into the camp and later taken on two death marches, collapsed on the second death march in the height of the winter and was left for dead in the snow, where the Russians found him and realized that he's still alive. So they took him to another liberated camp, into the hospital, where I found him 3 months after liberation, and took him to a sanatorium in Prague. He died of tuberculosis 4 months later. So why did I survive? The only other member of my family who survived was my brother. My brother who, when he found out that the family was taken away from home, escaped from the forced labor camp and joined the partisans, the freedom fighters, and fought the rest of the war and survived. And 3 months after the war, roaming around Europe, just looking for other Jews, hoping that some other Jews survived somewhere else, I ran into my brother. So I was very lucky. And that's when we found my father dying in this camp, and he died 4 months after. Basically, that is my story. I could tell you hundreds of other stories, which we never have time for. But I just wanted you to know what human beings are capable doing to one another. And it's happening in our lifetime, every day. And so that's why I decided that as long as my memory is intact, as long as my feet can carry me, I will be telling the story. So that, hoping that some people will understand and they will raise their children. This is the most important thing, that the next generation that we are raising today should understand, because this generation is already lost. And our enemies are out there trying to destroy us. So it is the next generation that will really have to fight what we have left to them. So thank you very much for inviting me. I really appreciate it. I know that we are about 10 minutes over. If you would like to ask me any questions now,
Explain the
Wiesenthal
Center.
The Wiesenthal Center is really now the Museum of Tolerance. And we have a wonderful exhibit of the Holocaust. By the way, they are renovating it now, so they are upgrading the exhibit. And we have an exhibit of finding your families, and finding your your roots of America. So we have some very interesting exhibits. And of course we have films of all the genocides of the 20th century. The 20th century in history will be recorded as the most violent, most brutal, most barbaric century in the history of mankind. So that has to be recorded, and the Museum of Tolerance is doing also that. And we have survivors who tell their stories. So it's a complete history. There is also another Holocaust Museum in Los Angeles, who is a smaller museum and is building a new building right now, who is strictly a complete history. There is also another Holocaust Museum in Los Angeles, who is a smaller museum and is building a new building right now, who is strictly a Holocaust.